From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with The Listen, the podcast that encourages community, cross-cultural dialogue, and open conversation. Today, another conversation in our bundle of interviews in our Season 10 series, Our Bodies in Space. We're talking about the voice-body connection, how we process trauma, and discovering a measure of comfort and confidence in our own skin. My guest today is Lauren Lovett. Based in Los Angeles, she is a graduate of the Juilliard School Drama Division in New York City. She has had specific vocal training with Patsy Rodenberg and Saul Kotsube. In addition, she studied education at Monmouth University, depth psychology at Pacifica Graduate Institute, and somatic experiencing with Peter Levine. For 25 years, Lauren worked as a professional actor in theaters across the country, including the Mark Taper Forum and the Geffen Playhouse in LA. She has also appeared on TV in ER, Guiding Light, Days of Our Lives, and The Whole Truth. She was the voice of the Childhood is Calling campaign for Rice Krispies for many years. She has been coaching actors and non-actor professionals for 20 years in voice, speech, dialect, and public speaking confidence. Companies include DreamWorks Animation, BSH, Morgan Stanley, and several others. She is a member of SAG-AFTRA, Actors Equity, and VASTA. Lauren Lovett, welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Kate.
Hi, it's so great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
I'm sure many of our listeners are thinking, Lauren Lovett, how can I place that name? And for some of them, it'll be one of these many credits that we read or that I read in the intro. And for others, it's because they hear your name at the end of every podcast that we do. You are our head producer and you've been with us from the very beginning. So it's about time you showed up.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That, no pressure. No pressure at all. Yeah, it's great to be here because we're about to get to our history together. But we've known each other for a very long time. I don't even know if we should say how long.
Yeah, we'll get there. But yeah. I want to start even pre-Kate and Lauren.
Sure,
if you
sure.
can even believe that that time ever existed. You are a graduate of the drama division, as we said, at the Juilliard School. So what can you tell us about the training you received there as a young actor?
I can tell you that it's probably pretty different now, because back in 1990 when I started, I just dated ourselves here, it was a very Eurocentric education, and male-centric, and you know, there was not a lot of diversity. Viola Davis was a year ahead of me, actually, and she was fighting the good fight along with a couple of her classmates to try to broaden the sensibility about diversity and race and all kinds of stuff. So she's spoken about that, but it was a narrower experience, I think, than it is for students now. But I will say that the classical training, the conservatory aspect of things, where you're there 8 a.m. in the morning doing your movement class and then your voice class and then your acting class and you have an hour for lunch and then you're there doing your classes and then at night 6 to 11, you're rehearsing whatever studio project, you know. So it was an immersion that I think other schools don't offer. Because you're doing like liberal arts classes or you're writing papers. And that was not the case here. It was just like full on all the time, very intense. So I'm really grateful for that because I think that while it may involve some trauma, to be honest, the intensity, because we're talking about the body and trauma and stuff like that, I do think that it increases our capacity as far as like what diligence is, what practice is, all that stuff. So I'm really appreciative of that aspect of it.
It sounds like an incredible foundation. And I'm wondering if you appreciated that at the time. I mean, you must have been 18 or 19 when you started there. It's a four-year program, as you said, it's a conservatory program, but like most university programs, it's 4 years. So is this something you've gained appreciation for over the years, or did you know at the time that that you were consciously laying a foundation?
You know, I mean, I had already been acting since I was 12 and doing long, you know, 4 month runs of shows and dinner theater, mostly musicals, really, which is kind of funny to think about. So at the time, I mean, funnily enough, I had always wanted to go to Juilliard, and I thought, oh my God, am I going to be good enough? And everyone's going to be walking around like batting their heads into lockers, reciting Hamlet over and over again. And while there was a little bit of that, it's also just people and young people. So, you know, there was partying and there were people that, you know, were making body jokes and doing stuff and not coming to class. And I was like, what? You know, but that's normal. That's what it is, especially at that age, like in late teens, early 20s. So I'm really appreciative of it as the years go by, because I use it in my teachings now, years and years later, just, you know, creating a practice for yourself and drills and things like that, and understanding the body and the voice and the breath, like that stuff that I learned, you know, in 1990 from Robert Williams, you know what I mean? And Liz Smith and all the people that had been teaching there at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, I wish we could, I almost wish we could spend the whole interview talking about, you know, what that experience looked like. It's fascinating to me. But I do want to jump forward. Let's talk about where I come into your story.
Let's talk about that.
So I believe, I mean, the show where we met, I believe, was the show when you got your equity card. So was that your first gig out of school?
Yeah, I had done a summer thing at, oh God, it was like the public theater had like these little grants that they were giving, these little projects. And I did something adjacent to that, you know, but really my first formal job was The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, where we played sisters and we took it on the road with TheaterWorks USA. We started in the fall of 1994. So yeah, that was your second gig, I think, but it was my first equity gig.
Yeah, I think, didn't you go to DePaul for a year and then transfer to Juilliard?
Yeah, I mean, not transfer because I had to start all over again, but originally okay. I had thought, you know, because I'm already from the East Coast and I'd always wanted to go to Juilliard, but honestly, the first time I auditioned, I got a call back, which is great and hard to get and hooray, but didn't get in. And they wrote me a letter, actually. And they were like, you know what? Try again next year. We really like you. And to be honest, like, it was the right thing. Because when I auditioned and I was still in high school, I came in like a Pittsburgh Steeler t-shirt. And like Duck Siders, this is 89, y'all, so forgive me. And I kicked off my shoes and I went in there and I don't know. I think they were just like, she's a little homegrown for this right now. Like she needs to put the soup is not soup yet. So I was mad, but then my mom talked me into going back and auditioning, and you know, they had said do that. So I did in Chicago while I was at DePaul and got a call back right there and got an offer. Quickly after that.
So even though you and I are the same age,
yeah.
There was a year one difference year. As far as graduating from college,
yes,
because of this
yes.
year that you had done in Chicago pre Juilliard.
Yeah. I didn't even finish that year actually. Mm. Because once you get in, you know, it's March and you're supposed to go till May or June. And I just was like, let me go back to my home state and do some waitressing and try to get some money in my pockets, you know? So
there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Okay, so you've already said the show. I know everyone was waiting with bated breath to know what was this show that you and I worked on. It was a children's theater production.
Yeah.
Actually, a lovely show.
Yeah,
a musical
really
for
well
children
put together.
Based on C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And since we were a merry band of five actors driving and one stage manager, driving around the country in a van with all of our costumes and sets. Oh my gosh, I still can't believe. And I believe our reel-to-reel sound system.
Yeah, it was reel-to-reel and then it was DAT. I think that's different.
Oh, right.
Yeah, we had a DAT machine.
Yeah, we went high tech.
Yeah.
That's right.
Oof.
Yeah, so that's when you got your equity card. As you said, I had gotten my equity card with the same production company the year before that, with a different show that I toured with for I guess there were two different shows that I toured with, but in any case, it was the same producer. And then you and I met on The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And because there were only five actors, we all were playing a variety of different parts. You played Susan, the older sister. I played Lucy, the younger sister. And I also played Mrs. Beaver.
Yes, you did. Unforgettably.
Memorably. And who else did you play?
Memorably. Well, the White Witch, Edmund.
Indeed.
Son. Yes.
Indeed.
My very
and I
favorite.
Just I have to throw in an anecdote, if you'll please excuse
please.
Me. I can't remember what state we were in. We traveled all over with that show, but always, either playing theaters where groups of school children were bussed in, or sometimes we were in schools. And in, I can't even remember where we were, but in any case, between shows, we usually played two shows, like a 9 o'clock and an 11 o'clock in the morning. And between shows, a teacher came backstage and asked our stage manager, hi, Ken, asked our stage manager if he could please ask the White Witch to tone it down.
Too scary.
And he, of course, was like, well, I'm not in a position to do that. This is the way she's been directed to play the part. And the teacher was so sweet. She said, okay, well, we had a child vomit because he was so scared.
I'm sure that's not the last person I've made queasy in my career as a coach, especially.
Again, another subject we could talk about for a long time.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so we'll get back to Kate and Lauren, but I think that was a nice little blurb on us. You worked as a professional actor. We heard several of your credits in the intro, a little bit about how things began for you out of school, on both stage and screen for many years. And then at some point you began to move more and to be pulled more toward teaching and coaching. So can you talk us through how that unfolded and what it looked like?
Yeah, it's funny. It comes to mind now and then, that saying of like, those who can't do, teach. But it's interesting to have done and then teach, because what I have been able to offer my students and my clients is like, I know what it's like. I know what camera work is like. I know what set is like. Not every set, of course. I know what it's like to be waiting in the wings before a show where you're the first person to come on stage, you open the show. I know what it's like to sing in front of 3,000 people. You and I did that. I know what it's like. I know what nerves are like. I know what, your body feels like in each of those spaces. So I realize the importance of a support person. How many times when you were acting did you think, oh, I wish I had like a go-to coach, or you actually did have a go-to voice teacher, these go-to peoples where you're like, oh my gosh, I've got to prepare this audition. I've got to prepare this role. Oh, my voice hurts, or I just feel like I'm hitting a wall in my acting. And to have somebody or a group of people, a team that you're just like, all right, I need to schedule sessions with this person. I need to call that person. I think every artist should have that in their life. And I'm proud to be one of those people, to be a support person.
What can you say about the voice-body connection? This is something that you and I have spoken with over the years, and I know many of our listeners will feel somewhat familiar with that term, but maybe not know exactly what it means. So what words would you put on that? How would you describe it?
Well, I would say, as I've been honing this idea, because I think we'll talk later, I'm about to put out some online courses next year. Mm-hmm. The voice-body connection is about feeling congruent. is about having your voice be the voice that you feel that you are, that connects with your breath, your body, your moods, that it's not disconnected from that. It's not like I had somebody come to me the other day and say, you know, I just don't feel like my vocal expression, like my voice is actually like me. It doesn't sound like I feel. It doesn't sound like who I am. And I don't have any flexibility. I feel like I'm just monotone, or I'm short of breath, or, you know, and it's like for everything to coalesce and be congruent with your soul, even, dare I say.
Yeah. And again, we will come back to some of these subjects a little bit later and go a little bit deeper. But I think in this, especially in the last 6 months, I mean, in this new Zoom society and, you know, work environment, and class environment, it's like even more, we have even more of a tendency than we did before to think of our voice as being something that sort of floats above our body instead of being something that's produced by our body and that our body can, you know, if our body is in the right place, if our alignment is there, then the voice sort of is produced naturally. You know, it's not like you don't have to sort of try to make the voice that sounds right. like you.
Yeah, ideally it's your natural voice that wants to come through. Mm-hmm. You can hear in the way that you speak and the way that I speak. It's that, you know, if we're experiencing some joy or excitement, you feel that in the voice. It's connected. It's when you don't hear that through the voice, you wonder, well, I can't really figure out where that person is, you know, how they feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We need to take a quick break, but we will be right back to continue our conversation with voice and speech coach Lauren Lovett. Back in a second. Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit rafsanpedro.es. That's RAFFSANPEDRO.ES. This is Kate Jetmore with The Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lauren Lovett. Let's talk about trauma. You mentioned this word at the top of the interview. I know it's a nice light subject,
yeah.
But it's a part of life for so many people, dare I say everyone.
Everybody. Yeah.
I know this is a subject that you have studied formally and it's an issue that you help your clients work through. So why don't we start by defining it? What exactly is trauma?
Trauma is an experience that, you know, especially in younger years, can shape the way your system handles stress. It can diminish your natural capacity. You know, it's like, I sometimes say in a sort of lighthearted way, it's like you've got this brand new car and you park it in the Costco parking lot. And then, you know, you've got some, maybe a brush by of a shopping cart, or kids come by and bang on it. And, oh, maybe somebody even, you know, when they're trying to park, rear ends it a little bit. So now that car's not so bright and shiny anymore. It's got some dings and slashes. And even if somebody's really, you know, T-boned it in the middle of the parking lot, there's a lot of residual things that happen because the body is a system. So we have trauma with a little t, which can be, you know, these sort of daily childhood humiliations, you know, like if you feel really uncomfortable in your skin as a kid. And there's also traceable things sometimes with in utero and perinatal around your birth as to why you might, as a second grader, already feel uncomfortable. There's also ancestral trauma, which is now more and more, you know, evidence studies that are out that say, yeah, we inherit in our DNA unresolved trauma of our parents and our grandparents and on down the line. So it's something that interrupts the natural systems of how you might deal with stress and just life in general.
I know there's probably a cultural element to this as well, and that each culture has its way of dealing with trauma. What can you say about how our Western society tends to deal with it or not deal with it? How are people taught to work through something like that?
Yeah, I mean, until pretty recently, it's been a culture, and I mean, it still is, it's a culture of escapism, you know, addiction, which again, didn't start today with you. You probably have that in your DNA if you're experiencing difficulty with addiction. It's like, okay, I feel really upset, overwhelmed, sad, terrified. How can I not feel this way? How can I just cancel this? How can I leave my body, dissociate? I mean, part of it is unconscious. It's a survival mechanism. But part of it is the way that we've been living for years and years, which is like emotion is not acceptable. You know, they used to, especially for women, there, and even Ratched is an example of a show that's out now where, oh, you're experiencing a hard time. You're having questioning about your own gender or your sexuality. Just give them a lobotomy, you know, let's make all of this go away. Shock treatment, etc. So it's only now where we're really saying, well, what if you just experience that emotion? What if you allowed the body to complete a protective measure that may still be in your body, but not complete because you weren't able as a child to protect yourself from something coming towards you, either emotionally or physically? What if we complete those things? What if we allow them to cycle through the nervous system? They actually become less and less and less potent. And then your capacity to experience those things and any other stress increases. That's basically sort of the theory now.
Okay. It sort of sounds like, like a pot of boiling water with a lid on it. Like if you just sort of leave it, you know, like we all do you can leave the lid a little bit off so that a little bit of steam is coming out and then it won't boil over. It sounds a little bit like what you're saying, like, you know, it's boiling, like, let's recognize that it's actually boiling.
Yeah. And if we stayed there with that rolling boil, what would we notice? What would we smell? Is it as scary when you let the boil roll and then you just reduce the temperature little bit by little bit? We deactivate the nervous system without pushing it away. And what we were just working on as I was finishing my final course of this 3+ year odyssey of somatic experiencing, which I know we'll talk about in a minute, is that you can hold a traumatic event or a feeling about it. You can have that. You can focus on it and also have a resource and also look at your dog and have a warm feeling while you're working on this trauma. You can do both at the same time. That also creates capacity. And that I'm really interested in.
Well, yeah, I was just about to ask you, and congratulations on completing your training. That's really exciting.
Thank you. It was literally last night.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just if there was ever an apt moment to use the word just, it's now. You just finished your training in, as you said, somatic experiencing. What is somatic experiencing? Can you define that for us?
I can. I mean, probably they do it better on the website, which is traumahealing.org, which I'll make sure is in the show notes. But it was kind of brought to the surface by a man named Peter Levine, and he has several books out. The first book, which I think is probably the best for people new to somatic experiencing, is called Waking the Tiger, which, you know, is kind of like what we were just talking about. And really, somatic experiencing is processing trauma through the body. You know, if you came to me and you said, well, I'm feeling really anxious these days, which I think probably everybody is with the election and, COVID-19 and all routines changing and what will happen next. And if you came into my office or now my Zoom office and you said, you know, I don't know, I can't sleep, I feel short of breath, and I would watch you. I would watch the body's unconscious thing, like little behaviors, like maybe your head would start tilting to the side a bit, or your lips would begin to tense when you were talking about it. Or I'd say, you know, Kate, where do you feel that anxiety in the body? So there may be a little bit of what's called content, which is the story. Oh, well, you know, I don't know, like Lucas just went back to school and I'm feeling all that. So there's the story, which is very real and very important. But we sort of use the headline of the story and then we say, well, where do you feel that in the body? And we start with the behaviors, as I said, but also the sensations in the body. And then does emotion bubble up? And does that feel familiar to your body? Like the first time you went to school, when you went, you know, and there was a separation from mother and things like that, you know? So we trace, there's so many things you can do, but we let the body lead instead of just doing talk therapy.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for defining that. And again, we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but you and I have taught some courses together. Well, a course that we teach together, and we've done it several times now. And one of the things that you've brought to our collaboration is somatic experiencing. And it's been so interesting to witness you working with our clients. And because this shift that you're describing, you know, asking your clients, where do you feel it in the body? You've brought that into our courses before. And more often than not, that is a very difficult shift for people to make. They're not used to being asked that question. And so 9 times out of 10, people say, well, I feel sad.
Which is fine.
I feel, yeah. Right. Yeah. No one's denying that you feel sad. And let's talk about that too. But listen to the question.
Yes, although I will say that sad is also a good place to start. And then we get more specific. Well, mm-hmm. Where is that sad in the body? Where does it feel the saddest? What's the saddest part? And then they might say, well, maybe in my throat, you know, I feel like that, like maybe it pulls down or constricts, because that's what happens when I'm feeling emotional or sad. Oh, so is it like elevator doors closing, or is it like a rope pulling it down? So we just, whatever clue it is, because it is really hard for people to move into their body, to feel emotion or sensation or either. And what's interesting is that's a lucky thing to nail an emotion right away. Most people that are not really in their bodies much will say, I don't know, nothing. You know, and then you're like, okay, well, how about your little toe? Do you feel any sensation in your little toe? Or how about your armpits? Shall we feel there? Is there heat? I mean, you just go for the smallest piece to invite people into the body, which honestly, there are reasons why people are not in their bodies, and it could be trauma, and they've dissociated to survive. So that's there too, you know?
And we've also witnessed those clients who, as you said, you know, you ask them, where are you feeling it, or what are you feeling, or where are you experiencing it in the body? And they say, I don't know. Meanwhile, their knee is bouncing up and down a mile a minute.
Yeah.
And it's like, in that sense, they're super in their body. Like they're holding onto something physically in their body, but they're not even aware of
they're
it.
They're not aware
We've
of
all
it.
Witnessed
so
that.
They're not in their body, but the body has held the trauma and the habituation of how they deal with the trauma. So they may not be cognitively aware of this knee going all over the place. So then you draw the attention. You say, well, you know, I'm noticing that your knee is doing a little dance. Do you feel that? And they say, oh, yeah, I guess I do that a lot, you know, and then we can have a conversation around, oh, well, when does that happen? It's endlessly fascinating. I'm just like in love with this practice, because if you are caring and you listen, the Listen podcast, if you listen and you're really present with someone, even when it doesn't feel like there's work being done by that person and their system, there is. There always is, even if they're resistant because they're protective, system is coming into play, like, oh, this is getting a little close, this feels weird, this feels, I'm getting anxious, like, even that is something.
Let's take another short break, and we'll be right back to talk more with Lauren Levitt. It is such a pleasure to share our interviews with you each week, and your feedback means the world to us. If you visit our new website at thelistenpodcast.com, you can let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. I'm also hoping you'll subscribe to our podcast. When you sign up and rate and review your favorite episodes, it helps widen our audience and bring more people into the fold. You can find us on social media and check out the Listen blog, also available on our website. Once again, that's thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with Lauren Levitt about somatic experiencing, how we process trauma, and finding confidence when speaking in public. Lauren, before we go on, why don't you let our listeners know how they can reach you, whether that's on your website or on social media?
Sure. So my website, you can either do my name, laurenlevitt.com, or SpeakWellUS, which is my company, but also we have our SpeakWell Global site as well. So the company SpeakWell, and we have US and Global. So you can see me and Kate on SpeakWell Global, but just me on SpeakWellUS.com. And I love Instagram. So the body's voice, it's possessive, but without the apostrophe. So the body's voice is my Insta handle. I'm not on Twitter because I just cannot deal with it at all. I just can't. So those are the two places. I have a Facebook page, but I'm not often on Facebook now.
Okay. Lauren, do you want to go ahead and talk about the online courses that you're about ready to launch?
Sure. I'm going to, if all goes well and I can get my butt in gear, I'm creating two online courses that are foundational courses, one in holistic dialect. So a lot of people come to me and say, oh my gosh, I have an audition for, you know, an Irish person in 1800 or what have you, you know, Northern Irish or this or that. So I sort of pull together some models of Irish accents and I make a little chart and we talk about where the sound is in the mouth and in the chest and, you know, what's different, what are the sort of landmark or gateway sounds that change from the way that the person speaks now to, you know, a Northern Irish accent. So I'm going to put out a course that helps you understand just the fundamentals, including a very simplified version of IPA, which is the International Phonetic Alphabet. And I like to call it the symbology of sound because it's not really based on spelling of words. It's really about the sound of language, you know, so that you can, it's transferable to any other language. It's this sound, oh, you know. So that's one course. The second course is going to be something like the foundations of creative life mastery. So it's really about what we've been talking about, connecting your voice to the body. It's about alignment, borrowing from the Alexander technique and some of my teachers' work as voice people. As well as developing your own preparation practice, ideally a daily practice to kind of keep yourself tuned up, as it were, but also using other parts of your creativity, like maybe we start sketching and drawing, or we're creating a one-man show for you, or one-woman show, and things like that. So it's kind of like, it's almost like the artist's way, but really through the lens of the voice and alignment, a little bit more three-dimensional.
And I think that people who want to make sure that they have access to those courses and find out when they actually become public can follow you on Insta for information about that.
Yeah, I would say that's the best place. I'll be doing, you know, emails and things like that. But really, Instagram is where I put up pictures of the desert, which I love, which is where I live right now part-time, but also any news of courses and specials that I'm offering Instagram.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. We'll have all that information up on our website as well. So we've talked about acting. We've talked about trauma and how to release it. And now I would really like to turn to your work in the field of public speaking. Who are the people who seek you out, and what is it exactly that they're looking for?
Well, mostly, you know, they've been rising up in their various careers, and they want to feel more comfortable. You know, they don't want to be so overwhelmed with nerves. They want their voice, as we were saying at the beginning, to express really their thoughts, their feelings, and who they actually are. Some people want to have sort of shapeshift, have different vocal personas, if you will, especially on Zoom. So they want to sound like more professional, more mature when they're sort of in this milieu. Whereas, you know, if they're on a date, they want to shapeshift into a really more accessible and friendly sort of vocal thing. And it's not really a presentation. It's just having a range and feeling connected and comfortable.
Mm-hmm. And who are the people that seek you out? Are some of them actors and some of them not actors? Who are the people who seek you out?
It's a mix of people. I mean, I have a lot of actors at many different stages in their career come to me for a lot of different reasons. And I usually work somatic experiencing there, either in a big way or in little subtle ways. But also people that are non-actors, I have directors. I mean, directors need to run a set, you know, our showrunner needs to command the set. So people are like, I don't know if my voice will even, you know, reach the next person over, you know, if I'm pitching. Mm-hmm. Am I really conveying the excitement that I feel? Also, mm-hmm. people in all different kinds of careers. I've had people in human resources who needed to speak to a group of people about, okay, what are the new things that are going on in the company? What were the survey results? I have lawyers. I have financial people that need to talk to people about their money, which is a really volatile mm-hmm. category. I mean, really, it's anybody that wants to improve their comfort with their own communication and voice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes lots of sense. And you already made reference to this before, and so did I, but now I'd like to turn to a project that you and I started, unbelievably, almost 3 years ago, SpeakWell Global. And what happened was we were sort of reconnecting after many years, and we discovered through a series of conversations in which you were describing your work and I was describing my work that if we came together, what we had to offer could really complement each other and help a whole new set of people. And that's when we founded SpeakWell Global. So do you want to describe the people that we've been able to help through SpeakWell Global and hopefully more in the future?
Yeah. Actually, it was you who really thought, you know what? You need to come on out here to Spain and we need to do this work together, you know, which I really appreciated and was kind of a lifesaver at the time, being able to work with you and develop curriculum and things like that. And what we ended up doing, based mostly on your footwork, was that we worked with people, teachers, professors, PhD candidates. We really were in the university system and also in the private sector with business people, people that do public relations internationally. And they each had their own reasons for why they needed to feel more confident. They needed to feel more alive with their voice. I mean, some of them were presenting these long research papers, you know, to get accredited or even compete for awards. And they just felt like they were sort of stuck in a scared monotone, you know? Mm-hmm. So we did these 16-hour courses that sometimes made a world of difference, and people were really emotional at the end and couldn't believe mm-hmm. how much their view of themselves and their voice and even their ease with these 10-minute presentations that everybody did at the end. They felt so free and it was mm-hmm. fun, you know? So
well,
I really feel good about
working,
that.
I had been working for years at that time, you know, 15 or 16 years already, teaching English as a second language to Spaniards. And when I heard you talking about the way that you work with your clients, I thought, oh my gosh, we could really help people who are experts in their field. And some of these people are just at the height of knowledge in their field. There's no one who knows more than they do in that field of research. And they're fine when they're speaking about it in Spanish. But then you put them into a situation where stress is extremely high and their English, you know, they're not native English speakers. Some of them don't even have a very high level to begin with. Others have a fairly high level, but maybe they struggle with pronunciation or they struggle with nerves. And suddenly, they do not seem like, sound like, or look like an expert in their field.
And yeah, it's not congruent with who they are.
Exactly. Yeah. And those were the mm-hmm. people that we were striving to help and did help. We have given, to date, we've given several of these 16-hour courses here in Spain. And now we're at the point where, you know, in this new world post-COVID, we are looking to see how we're going to offer our courses going into the future.
I will say that one essential ingredient that can help people who are sort of thinking about public speaking, even if it's just to your office mate or in a Zoom conference, is that, you know, if you were endeavoring to run a marathon or do any kind of event, you would think, well, I need to prepare somehow. Like I need to practice. I need to run a few miles, you know? I think we have this, I don't really know why. I guess because we speak all of the time to each other. This idea that, oh, I can just go into this public arena and do fine, you know? And then it's like, oh my gosh, why am I so nervous? Oh, why does my throat seize up? Oh, I lose my breath. Oh, I feel really, really tense in my shoulders. Well, because you need to prepare. You need to practice. And I think if we can get that idea across, or, you know, with SpeakBall Global, or I can through my courses or with my clients say, listen, this is a preparatory endeavor. You've got to at least days or weeks out from a speaking event or just developing that daily practice just to, you know, flood your system with, you know, get your lymphatic going, get your muscles kind of ready and greased up, the tongue and the face and the breathing and everything. It's a practice, and ideally a daily practice, you know?
Mm-hmm. Lauren, it's so great listening to you describe your work. It's so rich, and I'm so excited to hear about the various projects that you have on the horizon. I hope you'll come back in the future and talk to us again. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you very much, very, very much. And I'm probably going to see you in a business meeting later this week, but it's been really great to be in the guest chair.
It has been great, Lauren. Thank you.
Thank you so much for thinking of me for this.
Thank you for coming on the show. Next time on The Listen, we'll be joined by Ana Monbiedro, an architect who studies how our physical environment helps to shape our brains. Hope you can join us. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, where the surrounding province is home to three ancient Roman cities, Segobriga, Ercavica, and Valeria. If you enjoyed this interview, I encourage you to check out our full archive at thelistenpodcast.com. There are dozens of interviews waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. I want to thank our producer, Lauren Lovett, and EJ Jetmore, who handles our social media. And many thanks to Lucas Munoz Jetmore for editing the show, providing tech support, and writing our theme music. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is The Listen.